On this first episode of Season 3, I talk with Dr. Lee Scalarup-Bissett about pedagogy and technology, neurodivergence, and affective labor. Hello, listeners. Welcome to The Agile Academic, a podcast for women in and around higher education. This season, I talk with my special guests from all over academia about purpose, values, and what it means to be an advocate in higher ed for students, for labor, for kindness, and for balance and self-care. Hi, Lee. Thanks for being on the Agile Academic.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So why don't you go ahead and just tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
So I am Lee Scalarup-Bissett. I am the Assistant Director for Digital Learning at the Center for New Designs for Learning and Scholarship, also known as CANDLES, if you sort of put all the letters together. So I have to sort of pause because we never actually say the whole acronym. We always just say CANDLES. And so I have to remember to like, no one knows what CANDLES means if I don't explain it. But anyways, at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., it's interesting in our line of work, what titles do and don't mean and do and don't signify. But basically, I am a bridge between the sort of traditional faculty development, academic technology, and online and hybrid learning. And so I do a little bit of everything in that sense. So I do some traditional kind of faculty development as we understand it around pedagogy, but always with a kind of digital learning twist on it or emphasis. I also do the kind of standard technology workshops, consultations with faculty, and I have done some instructional design as well with the online. And so it's a lot of fun. Like I really like it because it's always something different, right? You get to engage with lots of faculty, but lots of different kinds of projects, you know, staying on top of the technology and just being able to, you know, especially during these times, as we say, capital T, capital, you know, both of them, these times, you know, we've been working really hard during the entire pandemic about getting faculty ready for remote learning. And now this kind of hybrid mix with students quarantining and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's been interesting because most recently, we have a biannual event called Digital Learning Days. And it was really funny because I'm, you know, assistant director for digital learning. And I'm like, you know what? We don't really need more digital learning. Like we need to create space for faculty to like take a break, reflect. If they don't know Zoom at the, like we can, you know, new faculty and all of that, we can help them get acclimatized to our, you know, technology ecosystem that we have and systems and structures. But like, I'm like, really, we need empathy. We need inclusive pedagogy. We need all of these kinds of things. And I'll throw in how they can do that using the technology available to them. But like more technology at this point is not the answer. And so it was sort of a really interesting position to be in where it's like digital learning days, but not really. So.
Awesome. So, yeah. Sounds like fun. And I think a lot of people will know what CANDLES is because it's kind of a famous, you know, powerful organization and does so much wonderful work. It's great to hear more of what you do in that environment. So when you think about, I'm going to dive into the deep end a little bit. When you think about kind of what your purpose is for your work in higher ed, what is maybe a driving force for you?
So I think that, you know, I've always wanted to make the learning environment for students better, right? To improve those sort of learning experiences, improve, like I'm at Georgetown now, but I have always been at public institutions prior to this moment. And I've always worked at public regional comprehensive institutions, usually of one form or another, whose primary audience are what we would largely umbrella and problematically call first generation students. Right. Or non-traditional students. So I've worked at a Hispanic serving institution. It was actually my very first adjuncting job when I moved to the United States. It was, it was at a Hispanic serving institution in California. And then I moved over to an HBCU. And then I worked in rural Kentucky, rural Appalachia. And even when I was working at the University of Mary Washington, it's a public liberal arts institution. my favorite thing was when I always ask in a job interview now, what are the students like at this institution? And it was told to me that the students there were scrappy. And I was like, that's interesting. And then I was like, yeah, no, they are. They're scrappy. I love this. So I've always had this sort of, as I was in the classroom and seeing and hearing the stories that the students had around their educations, around their goals, around the barriers that they've had to these, that I'm always, was always trying to create an environment where these students could thrive and succeed. And it's very limiting when you're a contingent faculty member, right? In particular, you have no say over the curriculum. You have, very little connection with the students, often beyond the small handful of classes that you teach over and over and over again. So there's no opportunities to really create those kinds of lasting relationships. At first, it was fun to say, tell my students, you're never going to have a class like this in your life, in your academic career. And then it got really depressing because you're like, yeah, this is like a one-off that you're going to hopefully love. But then it's going to be back to the usual grind when you leave this classroom. And so the combination of factors kind of got me into thinking about faculty development. I was also always very interested, particularly for the students, as I've always been a bit of a tech geek. I've always loved playing around with technology, using technology. And it was always, and again, I come from a very privileged background. And so it was always kind of a shock to me how a lot of the students didn't have that same exposure to technology, that same curiosity about technology around seeing the potential of it. And there was also the idea of lowered expectations, right? It's like, oh no, we can't introduce technology to these students because, we need to focus just on getting them to be able to write. They can't handle all of that other stuff. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I think we're doing them a massive disservice. So there is this openness to technology, this willingness to talk about pedagogy, and just the idea of being able to have a larger impact on the institution was really appealing to me. And so to be able to move into teaching and learning centers or academic technology centers, just to have a way to shape that, to shape those conversations, participate more broadly in those conversations, and to not just impact the students in my own class, but to impact students in many, many classes by impacting the instructors. And so, I think that's one of the biggest drivers for me, is I really do care about the student learning experience, and I want students to be successful. I think that it's really important. And so that's probably the most rewarding part of my work, is hearing the success stories from faculty of how it positively impacted the students who are in their class.
Yeah, it's really important, the work that faculty developers and educational developers do to support. It's a trickle down, right? We support we support the faculty, and they support the students in different ways. And we support students as well through the work that we do, as an important piece of the ecosystem for learning on campus.
And there's also the other element too, the trickle up, where we can be powerful advocates for the faculty and for the students up the chain. We can have, to varying degrees, obviously, depending on the institution and how it's set up and all that, have influence over decisions around the technologies, decisions around pedagogical approaches. We can consult on these things, particularly when it comes to things like tenure and promotion. We can advise, but also the more faculty, which the faculty are the most powerful force on a campus. And if you change enough faculty's minds, right, they can also have that upward push on administrators, on administration, to be like, we need to change certain things. And so we often see a lot of initiatives that may have started in, say, teaching and learning center, trickles down to the faculty, that then circle back around to put pressure on the administration to make changes, and important and significant changes, to improve the student learning. And even the faculty's jobs too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they have to, and I think we're really seeing this during the pandemic, I knew this is an adjunct, but like, the administration's finally starting to pay attention, but like, faculty working conditions are student learning conditions. That's what the new faculty majority has long said. And the faculty are falling apart right now. And so there's got to be some pressure on changes to take a step back and say, okay, systemically, what is wrong? What is going on? What do we need to change in order to maintain, to help keep students graduating and learning and keep the university running, right? So
Right. And we know that from the burnout research as well, that faculty well-being and health obviously impacts student well-being and health. And the students are in a place of trauma and, you know, deep concern. But we also, when we think about faculty, we also have to think about things like compassion fatigue and empathy fatigue. And how do we support the faculty, right? A lot of the interventions that we have for burnout and what you're talking about are individual interventions, right? They're coping strategies. We're not dealing with the systemic challenges, because it's easier to put a Band-Aid on one person right now than it is to make systemic changes, even though this really is the time to be doing those kinds of things while we're making a lot of other different changes to the way we think and the way we work in higher ed.
Yeah. And I'm going to jump ahead because I know what other questions, but this is why one of the things that I'm also really passionate about is talking about neurodivergence. And I guess it's not recent anymore, but then again, time has no meaning. But I was recently, not as a child, let's just say. So I was recently diagnosed with ADHD. And prior to that, with being undiagnosed, particularly as a woman with that, how ADHD presents in girls and women is often different from boys, and at least stereotypically, right? We think of the ADHD boy who can't sit still, who's, you know, disruptive in class. So it's all often very externalized. Whereas for girls and women, we often internalize it. And so our ADHD curdles into anxiety and depression, because we are trying to compensate so much for, we don't want to be hyperactive. We don't want to be, because that's not what good girls do, blurting things out. We don't want to be, and we're often very awkward and not very graceful. There's a lot of other like kind of physical comorbidities that come along with ADHD as well. And so, you know, that it was the depression and the anxiety and my own children getting diagnosed that led me to read about these and then finally get my own diagnosis. But, you know, they don't call them invisible disabilities for nothing, right? And we, for so long, because neurodivergence and mental health issues were often seen as individual problems, because they were so stigmatized and because nobody talked about them. Right. And, you know, it's really hard to change the system, like you said, with the Band-Aid, but like, that's always been like, why would they need to change the system when it's only like one person? Right. Because so many people aren't talking about it. So many people aren't articulating it. So many people don't even have the language to articulate it. Right. For anyone who has ever been told, what is wrong with you, in that exact tone. Right. And you're just like, I have no idea. You know, it's that opportunity to create space and have these conversations and saying like, the system, in the same way that we talk about how our systems are not set up for our disabled and neurodivergent students, the system is not set up for our disabled and neurodivergent colleagues in the staff and in the faculty. So, you know, in the same way we want to talk about pedagogical changes and systemic changes to help student learning, again, we need to have these conversations as well around neurodivergence, around mental health, and the systemic things that we can do in order to improve the working conditions, in order to improve the success, in order to not have those barriers. And I think it's important, like I said, like oftentimes people didn't even have the language to be able to articulate, right? Like they didn't even know what it was that they were experiencing. And it can be, you know, and that is also, again, one of the reasons why often ADHD and other things like autism often end up in depression in men and women, but particularly women, is because it does feel so isolating, right? You can't talk to any, you feel like you can't talk to anybody about it. You feel like you can't articulate it. And you think that you're the only one, right? Like I am, you know, you're different. And you have to, so A, you don't want to talk to anybody about how you're different. You don't quite understand how you're different. You just know that you're different. And then you don't want to be perceived as different, because that is bad, right? Difference is bad. And then, so then you just, it's all your own fault, right? Clearly everybody else has this figured out. I don't. So I must be the problem, right? And so again, you just don't talk about it. And so if you don't do that, then you can't address it in that sort of way and get help and find help and get community and make change. So I think it's, that's one of the reasons why I do think it's so important, is I think not only do I do this, you know, a lot for the neurodivergent students and those with invisible and visible disabilities to be like, no, you know, someone with ADHD, you know, someone, me, but also again, to be able to create space for adults within the system to understand themselves better, but then also to be able to articulate and advocate. And again, I think most importantly, and this is something that I've always done and always appreciated, is find community. You're not alone. And I think that that's really important.
Everything that you said related to ADHD, we could swap out with burnout, and it's very, very similar. The stigma attached to it, you don't look weak or different. You can't have conversations about it. So, I mean, I was deeply terrified when I actually had to do something about it. It was terror moments, right? And after I had those conversations with colleagues that I needed to have for my own well-being, you know, I had a day of panic attacks because I figured I had ruined my reputation by admitting that I had this problem, quote unquote problem. So how do we create psychological safety for faculty and staff? Staff absolutely work with our students and are big support systems for our students as well. How do we make space for having those conversations and finding that community?
So that's the big question, right? I'm going to plug my book, because I just recently edited a book for, I always get it wrong, University Press of Kansas. Is that what it is?
I think so.
Yeah. Called Affective Labor and Alt Act Work. And basically it encompasses staff. And I put out the call about the kinds of affective and emotional labor that staff are doing within higher education. And that's kind of this is how I've sort of worked to create community, is there's a validation. Right? I'm working to validate these conversations as important, but also scholarly and serious, right? By having a university press. Would I love to do it open access and make it freely available? Sure. But I also know the importance of having a university press's approval of a book like this. So the individual contributors, for sure, right? As well, saying that I have this publication with a major university press. But also to the audience, saying like a major university press is putting this forward. And so it gives it legitimacy, right? It gives everyone the legitimacy to say, this is an important conversation. This is a legitimate conversation. This is a serious conversation, a scholarly conversation. So one of the things that I'm working to do is to try and give it legitimacy through these kinds of ways. But again, one of the biggest questions that I asked, because I'm doing a companion podcast series with the authors. Because of course we put in the manuscript in January of 2020 and then COVID happened.
Of course.
So it was a chance for, I wanted to give a chance for the contributors to go back to what they had written and add anything if they wanted to, right? And also just to plug and promote the book, you know. And one of the questions that I asked at the end is, what's next? We're identifying affective labor. We're saying it's important. Everybody's sort of in agreement, more or less, right? At least in the book, obviously. But like, what would you like to see happen next? And then that's the challenge, right? Like, what do we want to see our institutions do? What kinds of spaces do we want to create? And for me, one of the things that I'm torn, right? Because I want to see it recognized. I want to see it discussed. I want to see it legitimized, but I don't want to see it commodified, that it becomes just another thing that gets ticked off, right? We have to, you know, you will perform emotional labor, like, and also the whole gendered and racialized expectations around who does it and who doesn't. And it's like, oh my gosh, the white male teacher was empathetic, you know, and it's like, you weren't empathetic enough. And that you see that on teacher evals, let's say, and then all of those expectations. So, you know, I'm sort of torn. Like, I want to create the space. I want to be able to have these conversations. I want it to be recognized, and I want people to be rewarded. You know, I want people to feel supportive, but it's like, so we have a workshop on it. Like, I'm in that space now where I'm struggling with that question of what's next. What do I want to see? At the minimum, I would love to see we do teaching circles, and it's kind of like I'd like to at least see teaching, something like a teaching circle, where it is just a space and a place where people can get together and talk about these. But then at a certain point, you have to identify it, but then you got to do something about it, or else it's just endless discussion around this topic, a topic that's actually really difficult. Like, you can only, probably seen this in burnout, you can only talk about burnout so much before it's like, okay, I've got to talk about what comes next. Right. And I I'm not sure. Like, that's why I want people to read this book. I want people to take that question, and I want them to take it to their institution, to take it to their colleagues, and, you know, and then report back. Right. Like, I would love to do volume two, what's next? Because, you know, I think that's the only way that it's going to change. I don't have all the answers. I really wish I did, but by putting something out in the world where it's like, here's at the very least the question, now let's collectively try to find an answer to it and see what we can come up with and see what works.
Yeah. So much of what you're saying is why I wrote the burnout book, and why I feel like having those conversations are so important, that we need to be able to have those conversations. People need to have the language to have those conversations. We need to be able to manage our own burnout, but we also have to fight the culture that is creating it for us. You know, burnout is a workplace phenomenon. So how do we make sure that the word is out so that we can have these conversations and build some psychological safety? And you're right about what's next. At my institution, I run a Women Plus burnout support group once a month. And we often hear from people who say they want to come, but they're not willing. They're not at a place where they can have this conversation yet. And the women that do come, you know, get a lot of comfort from it and can identify with each other and feel like they're not alone. But again, that's a coping strategy, right? Mm-hmm. That's not a systemic change. So what do we do to change that? And it's something that I've been thinking about a lot lately, since the book is mostly about coping strategies. What do we do systemically? I don't have any big answers right now, but it's got to be top down and bottom up, I think, at the same time.
Yep. No, exactly. It's like going back to that top down, bottom up that we're talking about in Changes of Pedagogy and Student Learning, right? Where you do have to create the space to have the conversation. Then you have to build up the momentum. You have to kind of get up that curve, right? You have to get enough people so that there is momentum. So it's not just you against the world, right? Or a few of you against the world. But then, like you said, when you get that critical mass, right? What are we going to do with it? Like you said, it's so big and so systemic that, like I said, we need the entire community in on this. We need everyone's ideas, everyone's work, everyone's brilliance to be able to figure out a solution. And I'm hopeful. I think you are too. We wouldn't have written the books, right? Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have been talking about it all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't doom and gloom. This is a thing. Let's look at the thing. Let's acknowledge the thing. Let's admit that the thing is important and big and probably bigger than we even realize. But then once we get all of that, then we got to start the work. Then the real work starts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I can't wait to read your book.
So Amazon says April 2nd.
Okay.
There's a pre-order. I will make sure that you have the pre-order link.
Absolutely.
To put in the show notes. The companion podcast, they're recorded. I just have to edit them.
That's the hardest part.
I know. Like the ADHD, like this is the ADHD brain, right? I'm going to do a podcast. And then now I have to re-listen to everything and make decisions and find cuts and all of that kind of stuff. And that's the stuff that the ADHD brain is like, oh, tune in. Or at least mine. Other people are like, I love to edit. I hate the recording. It just depends. But like for me, it's my ADHD brain is like, really, do we have to? And so I tell a story. I have another podcast that I do with my colleague and friend, Amy Morrison, called All the Things ADHD. We're both academics. We're both in our 40s. We both got sort of late in life ADHD diagnoses because our kids got it. And we decided, I was like, hey, look at, because we both got our diagnoses at about the same time as well. And so we'd been talking and that kind of thing. And I'm like, what if we started a podcast? She's like, oh, that'd be great. So it was October. It was ADHD Awareness Month. That's what sort of sprung it. And we ended up having like a 3.5 hour conversation that I recorded, or like two of them or something like that. And then I was like, well, we can't release a 3.5 hour long podcast. So I'm going to have to edit these. Okay. So I bought a domain. I had set up, installed WordPress. I had everything. A year later, ADHD Awareness Month rolls around again. And I'm like, huh, I never edited the podcast. Maybe I should do that. So we had a recording booth at in the university library. We have a lot of great technology. And one of the things we have is a recording booth. And so I rented it out. I reserved it. And I had, leading up to that point during my daughter's ballet classes, where it's a nightmare because it's a cacophony of like seven different studios playing seven different songs on seven different counts in seven different styles. And so I got my noise canceling headphones and I sat there during her, this is obviously pre-COVID, I sat there with my laptop re-listening to all the podcast episodes and like marking down time and like actually being meticulous about these things. And then so had everything organized about where I was going to cut and what each episode was going to be. I spent 5 hours in the editing booth, back to back to back, in the true ADHD hyperfocus. You know, the bathroom, forgot to eat, you know, didn't bring enough water, and it was like 1,000 degrees in there. But I got them all done. I just got to and like push through at the very end. I was like, come on, I got like two more episodes to go. We got to do this. And then was able to push them out. Now we much more reasonably will typically have a time once a week where we talk for an hour. And then like, that's, you know, that's the episode. Sometimes we'll do a little bit longer and I'll just have to make one cut in the middle. But like we learned that we can't do 3.5 hour conversations. That is not sustainable. But yeah, basically I have to find the motivation to do that with these. I actually printed up next to me. I have the printed up sort of rough transcripts of all of them. So I can kind of read through them, see what's there and what's not, and then start making some decisions and then probably just block off an afternoon. I don't have to go to the sound booth anymore, but block off an afternoon. I'm in GarageBand and just pull these all together. So I'm hoping, the plan was that they would come out leading up to the release of the book. So sort of count backwards the number of weeks before and how many, I don't even know how many episodes I'm going to end up having. Count back and then have one done every week leading up to the release. That's the dream. The reality may be that they're released at the same time as the book from April 2nd on. Again, it's already February next week and I don't know where time went. So it's the behind the scenes of podcasting when it's not your main job.
I think one of the things that always impresses me about you is how much content that you generate and how important the content is for folks in higher ed to read. So what's your secret for being productive? Because you podcast, you write for higher ed media, you've got a book coming. What's the secret?
Have ADHD and have words be your superpower. My husband often jokes and joked long before, he's like, you have all the words. And it is one of those things where the ADHD brain is never quiet. It is never quiet. Like if there's only three things going on in my head, that's a good day. And so it's one of those things where I've always loved writing. I've always written. I say in a lot of cases, writing saved my life in a lot of ways, where when I couldn't externalize or articulate what it was I was feeling, what it was I was experiencing, when I was being gaslit, essentially, because this happens a lot too, you know, you probably know around burnout as well, but when you're neurodivergent and don't know it, but even sometimes when you do know it, there's a lot of gaslighting. Inadvertent at times, obviously, but there's a lot of, no, that's not right. No, that can't be. No, you don't, you know, you're not experiencing this, or there's a lot of invalidation. And so I learned very quickly that writing was one way that I could, I didn't have control of anything else in my life. I could at least control my writing, right? And how I wrote and how I narrated my life to myself through my writing. So they say that you know, 10,000 hours or whatever it is. I probably got those 10,000 hours done just in high school, right? Just journaling constantly. And so like it's in the way that, in the way that there's a, you know, that there's the scene in Good Will Hunting, mm-hmm. when Matt Damon's character is trying to like explain how he gets math to Skylar, his girlfriend. And he uses the idea of like Beethoven looking at the piano. It was Beethoven, Mozart, I don't remember. And that like, it just made sense to him. That's how writing feels to me. It just makes sense. And so it is my hyper-focus. It is my superpower. It's something that and again, I've also had to learn that I can't take the usual writing advice, right? It's like write every day and set aside time and keep a routine. And that's the ADHD nightmare. And so I had to learn and be okay with, I word vomit. They say, oh, don't word vomit. Nope, I have to word vomit. That's how I get all that content out. I word vomit. I also am very good at letting it go now, which wasn't always the case, where it's like, I'm going to write something. And once it's written, I'm like, it's done, right? Like you were saying about the podcast. Sometimes you just want to do that. And I, you know, I've learned to work with editors that I trust and outlets that I trust, so that I know that there is going to be someone there who is going to edit my work in order to make it better, right? That this is, editing is not my strength. I'm not as good as editing is, particularly my own stuff. And so I've learned that it's like, yeah, I've got to surround myself with people who are good at these things and who will help my writing be better and trust that they're going to do it. So I can just be like, okay, it's done. I'm not going to stress out over it. I'm just going to send it to the editor and then we can have a conversation around it. So, and that's hard for a lot of people. A lot of people will not press send.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Until, like, every word is perfect. And I'm like, nah, it's good enough. Good enough is also my mantra. It's just like, is mm-hmm. good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, this, it's not going to be perfect. So that helps as well. But it's also just the, like, again, that sort of having multiple things going on. So it's like, you know, I tried it once. I actually did try it once where when I got my job at University of Mary Washington, so I worked there for a few years. And it was by far like the biggest opportunity that I'd ever had. I was working at DTLT, Division of Teaching and Learning Technologies. We were working on Domain of One Zone. We were looking at all of these like really cool things that I was going to be able to do. And I still didn't have my diagnosis. And I said, you know what? I'm letting everything else go. I'm not going to stop the freelance. I'm going to stop all of this stuff. I'm just going to focus my attention on my job. And I was miserable. Mm. Because I needed all of that other external stimuli in a way that I mean, you could say, oh, it's external validation. It's also a dopamine hit. And that's what my ADHD brain wants. But it's also that I have so many different interests and so many different things I want to talk about, things I want to explore. And so giving myself outlets for those where I don't necessarily, I have certain parts of my job and are very, very fulfilling. But it doesn't fulfill all the things that I'm interested in, all the things that I want to do. And so I create those opportunities, and those opportunities sort of help nourish me. Like, and again, my husband always says, he's like, the busier you are, the happier you are. Mm. Right. And it is true. And I actually learned that the hard way. Not that I don't hit a wall occasionally, because that's the other thing ADHD people do. We do too much. And then it's like, But again, like as I know the diagnosis now of ADHD, as I understand it better, as I understand myself better through the lens of my neurodivergence, I'm now able to better understand and control my energy levels, understand what my limitations are. I'm at a point in my career where I can say no to things. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm at a point in my career for my writing, with my writing, that I can pick and choose, right? So I can shoot, you know, I'm not trying to shoot it off and be like, I need to get a chapter published. I need to get something published. It's like, I don't need to get anything published. So I'm only going to write the things that I really think are important, but also put them in outlets and in spaces with people that align with my values and that I trust, right? Who are going to do the right thing by my writing, but also just like, they're going to be a pleasure to work with. Like I like working with them. I know them either socially or reputationally. And so I'm going to work with them because that's something I want to do, as opposed to the other sort of motivation around publishing, which is like, I just have to publish something. And so there's something, when I went alt-ac and when I really said, okay, the tenure track isn't for me, it was really liberating because it was really like, I don't have to write anymore. I'm going to write what I want to write. And I'm not going to worry that people are like, blogs don't count. Podcasting is silly, right? And this was, again, 10 years ago. Now everybody has a podcast. But yeah, I mean, I was able to let all of those worries go because it's like, I don't have to stress about a podcast not, or a blog post or a blogging not counting. Like, it counts. It matters. It might not matter to the tenure and promotion committee, but like, I don't have to answer to them anymore. So screw you guys. I'm going to write what I want. And that's, you know, again, that was a really liberating factor as well, to being able to sort of channel my energies in a place where it mattered to me rather than the place where I thought they wanted me to be or that I needed to be.
I love that. And I really connect to that too. I left the tenure track 2.5 years ago. I had tenure, and it was liberating in the sense that I'm going to do this writing because I want to. I don't need this book to get promoted to full or anything like that. I just feel like it's important and I want to get it out there. So, and there's stress associated with that, of course, but yes, it's, you know, the power of what you're writing and the power of what you're putting out is crucial to our community, right? And making sure that our community is looking at these important issues from different angles.
Yep. Oh yeah. And I think that I do weigh things now. Like I said, with Kansas publishing at Kansas, right? It's like, okay, I write for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Okay, I do that. And everybody's like, oh, paywall. Oh, you know, I can't access your work and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but if I don't publish in Chronicle of Higher Education, people aren't going to take it seriously. So I still do some of these trade-offs, right? Where I want to, I'll send a PDF of it, whoever asks me for it all the time. But I really like my editor there. My editor there is phenomenal and I owe her something. It's just been busy. But again, like these are kind of the factors that I'm saying. I'm like, okay, I have a really great editor. She knows my voice and always makes my writing better. And it gets to an important audience who will give it more legitimacy because I have published it in Chronicle of Higher Education. Important factors. And that does a lot of work for our communities, for the community as well, right? Is that this shows up if it shows up in the print issue, I had one thing show up in a print issue. And I'm like, that is the gold standard, right? That's what the administrators read. That's what's sitting there in their office. They read the Chronicle. And so I'm like, these are important things that need to be done. But if I didn't have a good editor, I wouldn't like push it, right? I would be like, I will find another place to put my writing. But it so happens that I have a really good editor as well. And I like, okay, I like publishing here and it's good for the community that I do.
And it's great advice to work with an editor if you can. If you really want to get your writing or your work out there, having an editor. I mean, my editor at Johns Hopkins is amazing and I couldn't have finished the book without his support and his suggestions. So yeah, if you have a good editor and you build a relationship with them, it's your work will be better, absolutely better.
Yeah. And the flip side of that is if you don't have a good editor, walk away.
Yeah, agreed.
Right. You know, I've had a friend who, like, it's not that they were a bad editor. They just didn't see eye to eye on the vision of the book. And I was just like, well, at this point, you just have to pull it and go elsewhere because this is, it's not working. You're miserable. Sure. They're miserable. You don't need this. And again, that's a position of privilege because it's somebody who didn't need it. Right. Like, right. You know, for a junior scholar or a graduate student or something, like you just feel like you need that book. There are other editors. There are better editors. There are, you know, and that's the, there are other opportunities, right? It might not feel like there's a huge publishing landscape right now, but there's a huge publishing landscape.
Really is. Yeah.
Right.
Really
then is. There's space for that. And there are people, you know, there are people out there who will get your voice and get what it is that you're trying to do. And they will help nurture it rather than trying to turn it into something that it isn't. And it can be hard to find those people. But when you do, it's phenomenal, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's your writing sings, the ideas sing, and it's so much the end product is going to be so much more resonant as well because it'll come through in the writing and to the readers.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to take a mini detour and I want to talk about your amazing sewing habit, your amazing sewing hobby. You're always,
if you can, I know this is a podcast, but behind me is actually my sewing nook.
Love it.
In here that I just sort of flashed, and that's, I'm very proud of it. This is the most organized I am in my life.
Very clear.
Yeah, it is. And I'm constantly refining it too, right? Like I just put up baskets on the wall to like organize my printed patterns. That's a big deal for me. Like I usually things are just in piles, right? If you look at my desk is just piles, but like my sewing stuff, I've got it like a little bit better organized and everything. Yeah. It was a pandemic hobby. It was late in the pandemic. It wasn't like the first thing that I did. I tried the bread thing and was like, eh. I was proud that I made it. I didn't think I'd be able to make it. And I was like, hey, it's great. But for the amount, and it's, I had a really easy recipe too, that it was, but it, again, this is the ADHD thing. It takes time. So it's this no knead bread that's really easy. So it's like yeast, water, flour, knead, sit. So you have to wait for 24 hours, but then you have to do something and then it's 2 hours. And then you have to preheat something and then it's 4 hours. So like you get this wonderful loaf of bread, but it takes 24 hours to do, a little bit more than 24 hours to do. And the kids finish it in 8 seconds. And then if I want fresh bread every day, then I have to think 24 hours in advance to like do. And it's like, no, this is too much, even for easy bread. But it's just like those steps and the pauses and the coming back and remembering and mm-hmm. setting timers and all that kind of stuff. Whereas with sewing, it's funny. Like the thing that you do the least in sewing is actually sewing. There are so many different activities, right? So now it's all printed patterns like that you get on PDF and you have to assemble them, which I love doing because it's the easiest puzzle in the universe. Hmm. And printers don't do their job right still. They have one job and they can't do it. And so even though every piece is supposed to align perfectly, they never do. Right. So you tape it all and then you cut it and then you have to pick the fabric and then you lay and cut the fabric and then you have to start assembling it. And then so you're pinning and you're sewing and you're pressing. And then you like, it's like, all right, now sew the seams. Zoop. All right, it's done. Now I have to do 10 more minutes of prep work to sew like for 30 more seconds. And then your machine, the thread runs out or it gets caught and stuff. And you just, but there's enough sort of different activities and you're constantly going from one thing to another, to another, to another in these kind of bite-sized bits that just really, like, I never thought it would appeal to me, but it's really appealing to me. And the other thing that I realized as I was going through this is that this is the first thing that I'm doing that is only just entirely for me. No one in my family has any interest in me sewing clothes for them. It's fine. I am doing this strictly for me. I make a piece of clothing for myself that I want to make. In the fabric I want to make it, in the style I want to make it, all that kind of stuff. And it's just for me, you know? And yeah, I blog about it because that's who I am. But I don't care if people read the blog or not. I'm just there. It's also just sort of a record of what I've made, mm-hmm. you know? And so it was really, I want to say it's probably one of the most selfish things I've ever done, which kind of feels nice.
Yeah.
It's not hurting anyone. It's not selfish in a bad way. I mean, okay, it's hurting our bank account.
It's like the knitters who are always buying.
Yeah. New thread. Oh no.
Yeah.
My husband's like, why are you buying more fabric? Why are you buying more patterns?
And I'm like, I'll have to introduce you to my sister.
Possibly make all of these dresses or all of these outfits. And are you ever going to use all this fabric? I don't know. Maybe.
Could happen. Right.
Yeah. Could.
It could happen.
Maybe.
Okay.
I'll try. And then my brain's like, challenge accepted.
Awesome.
My husband's like, oh, my kids are like, oh God. they know now. They're like, is it more fabric, Mom? I'm like, shh. They're like, Mom, you don't need any more fabric. I'm like,
but I can.
Yeah. So. I might. It was on sale.
Well, I'm sorry to have to wrap this up. It's been such a lovely conversation. Do you want to just take a minute and plug your podcasts or your book so folks know where to find them?
Yeah. And I'll give you all of these links for the show notes. So one thing that I didn't get to plug yet with the writing question, which is relevant, is that just recently this came out in the Digital Rhetoric and Composition Journal, Kairos. It was interview with myself, writing with ADHD. And so I did it in this digital platform called Twine and made it kind of like a choose your own adventure, but you can randomize everything. And I really try to explain what writing is for me and what my writing process is, while also trying to emulate the experience of having ADHD with the Twine. And so I'm really, really proud of it. It's probably the most me I have ever been in my writing and my work. And I'm just really excited about it. And so I'll drop a link to that in there. Awesome. Affective Labor and Alt-Act Careers from Kansas is again coming out according to Amazon April 2nd. In the show notes, I'll make sure that there's a link at least to the Kansas page. If you want to look for it on Amazon, go ahead, but I'll give you the Kansas University Press. Very reasonably priced, $24.95. Like not wow. gonna, Very yeah, reasonable. No, I know. I was like, yeah. yes, yes. Awesome. And then the podcast, I'll give a link to, I don't even remember the site now that I made for the podcast because ADHD, but I will put a link to the website where the podcast is going to live. But once it's there, it'll be on all of the major podcasting networks. And just today, it's Friday today. And so this morning, a new episode after a holiday break, a new episode of All the Things ADHD just dropped. And you can find that, just search All the Things ADHD on any of your podcasting platforms. That's it. But you can also go to allthethingsadhd.com and that's where you can find it. And it's a lot of fun. So that's, and I'll make sure all of that gets sent and is in the show notes. So you can just click on it rather than having to, you know, use Google, because that's one step too far. As if you listen to the podcast, you know, there's one too many steps naming our just out. We're like too many steps. Also why we never ask anyone to rate our podcast, because we know they never will. And we don't want to make them feel bad for not doing it because ADHD.
Well, it's been great. It's been great chatting with you, Lee. Thanks so much for your time today.
No, oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Agile Academic Podcast for Women in Higher Ed. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. To make sure you don't miss an episode, follow the show on Apple, Google, or Spotify podcasting apps and bookmark the show. You'll find each episode, a transcript, and show notes at theagileacademic.buzzsprout.com. Take care and stay well.